Good morning. I'm now calling this first Standing Advisory Committee meeting of 2008 to order. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for being here this morning. New and continuing members and official observers of the Standing Advisory Group, PCAOB board members and staff, everyone here who is supporting the functioning of this meeting, those here to observe, and also those listening in on our webcast this morning, welcome. I would like to add my very special welcome to the new and reappointed members of the Standing Advisory Group. In May 2007, the board began soliciting nominations for the members whose terms were expiring this year. The board received many nominations from prominent and highly qualified persons from whom you were selected. Thank you for generously accepting this appointment and to participate in this very important role at the PCAOB. I also want to thank all those who submitted nominations and the continuing SAG members in each of the observer organizations for their commitment and participation. Because we have so many new faces at the table today, I would like to take several minutes to go around the table and have each of you very quickly introduce yourself. When doing so, please don't forget to turn on your microphone and to speak directly into it. I'm Tom Ray. I'm PCAOB Chief Auditor and Director of Professional Standards, and I'm also the Chairman of the Standing Advisory Group.
I'm Jennifer Rand. I'm Deputy Chief Auditor in our Standards Group at the PCAOB.
I'm Dick Dietrich. I'm a Professor of Accounting and Chair of the Department of Accounting at The Ohio State University.
I'm Ernie Ball with Mayor Hoffman and McCann, CPA firm.
I'm Kurt Schacht with the CFA Institute, the Chartered Financial Analyst Group down in Charlottesville.
Randy Fletcher, I'm the Vice Chairman responsible for professional practice at Ernst & Young and for the current year the Chairman of the American Institute of CPAs.
I'm Liz Fender. I'm a Corporate Governance Advisor with Governance for Owners in Charlotte, North Carolina.
I'm Bill Gradison, a member of the board.
Wes Williams with Crowe Chisk & Company. I'm in charge of the firm's national office functions.
Ed Nussbaum from Grant Thornton. I'm just here as a panelist.
It's a very important role, Ed. Thank you.
Greg Jonas from Moody's, here serving two roles today, both as a new SAG member and also as Ed Nussbaum's bag carrier.
David Becker, I'm a lawyer at Cleary Gottlieb Steen & Hamilton.
I'm Vin Coleman. I'm the professional practice leader at PricewaterhouseCoopers.
I'm Pat Harnett. I'm the president of the Ethics Resource Center.
Dan Gelzer, I'm a PCAOB board member.
Shelley Stein, I'm a partner with Grant Thornton and a returning SAG member, and I'm here to watch Ed Nussbaum today.
Good morning. I'm Gary Kabrick. I'm Vice President, Chief Accounting Officer of Xerox Corporation.
Hi, Arnie Hanisch. I'm the Chief Accounting Officer at Eli Lilly and Company.
I'm Bill Miller, Senior Investment Officer for the Ohio Public Employee Retirement System.
Zavonna Palmrose, Deputy Chief Accountant, Office of Chief Accountant at the Securities and Exchange Commission.
John White, Director of Corporation Finance at the SEC.
Russ Golden, Director of Implementation Activities at the FASB staff and Chair of the Emerging Issues Task Force.
I'm Bob Dacey, the Chief Accountant at GAO.
David Julian, General Auditor at Wachovia Corporation.
Good morning. I'm Liz Gantner. I am a CPA with Stegman & Company, Director of Quality Control.
Joe Costello. I'm a Professor of Accounting at the University of Tennessee.
Wayne Collins, National Director of Assurance, BDO Seidman.
John Morrissey, Managing Director and Controller of the Fortress Investment Group.
Mark Olson, PCAOB.
Barbara Roper, I'm Director of Investor Protection for the Consumer Federation of America.
Lynn Turner.
So.
Well done, Lynn.
Bob Kippers, I'm Deputy CEO of Deloitte LLP in the United States. I am either a continuing or a returning SAG member. I really don't know, but I'm here either way.
Warren Malmquist, Vice President, Internal Audit and Ethics for Olson Coors Brewing Company.
Charlie Niemeyer, Board Member, PCOB.
Chuck Noski, I'm a retired Vice Chairman of the Board of AT&T and currently Chair of the Audit Committees of Microsoft Corporation.
Senior Vice President, Chief Accounting Officer, and Corporate Controller of Comcast Corporation of Philadelphia.
I'm Galen Hansen, one of four Coloradans on this committee. I'm also a partner with Earhart, Keith Steiner, and Hotman in Denver, a large local firm where I'm the partner in charge of quality assurance. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy.
Good morning. I'm Bob Tirola. I'm Chief Financial Officer of W.R. Grace.
Cindy Richland, the Director of Corporate Governance for the Employees Retirement System of Texas.
Howard Johnson, I'm the retired head auditor at Lowe's Companies and JCPenney.
I'm Mike McCauley, Senior Corporate Governance Officer with the Florida State Board of Administration.
Greg Skates, Deputy Chief Auditor, PCAOB.
And I think we had at least one person come in. John, would you like to introduce yourself?
John Kellis, Chairman of International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board. And sorry, I missed the run round. Could we just go round again?
Perhaps at the end of the meeting. Thanks, John. Is there anyone else who hasn't had a chance to? Okay, great. There's one thing I would just like to note. Jeff Steinhoff recently retired from the U.S. Government Accountability Office. So, sorry about that, Bob. He had a long and distinguished career in public service, and he actually provided observer comments to the Standing Advisory Group since our very first meeting. And I just wanted to recognize that his retirement, and if he's listening in, thanks, Jeff, for all of your contributions. And just want to welcome Bob Dacey, who is taking over that role for the Government Accountability Office. So thank you all for introducing yourselves, and I welcome you to the SAG. Before we move on to the agenda, I have one announcement to make. I am pleased to report that yesterday the board approved the staff's recommendation to issue for public comment a proposed new auditing standard and related amendments to the board's quality control standards. The proposed standard engagement quality review would supersede the board. I encourage everyone listening to obtain the proposal from the board's website. We have three significant items on our agenda today. There continues to be an intense focus on the importance of accounting and auditing to our capital markets and to society in general. There currently are two federal advisory committees studying issues affecting the auditing profession, one sponsored by the Securities and Exchange Commission and one by the Department of the Treasury. This morning, we will learn about and discuss implications to the auditing profession of a recommendation of the SEC's Committee on Improvements to Financial Reporting that is related to professional judgment. Two members from the advisory committee will provide an overview of the recommendation to frame our discussion. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act includes provisions that speak to the auditors and the audit firm's responsibility to supervise audit work and to supervise persons associated with registered public accounting firms. Today, we will hear a presentation on the supervisory concepts included in the securities laws, and we'll seek your advice to help the board in its consideration of how it should approach the concept of supervision. In October, we discussed with you a number of possible implications of the SEC's proposal and concepts release related to the filing with the SEC of financial statements prepared in accordance with International Financial Reporting Standards, as issued by the IASB. One of the subjects discussed was one of the board's interim quality control standards, known as Appendix K. Today, we will hear from a panel composed of representatives from registered public accounting firms about the quality control practices of their international networks.
The purpose of this session is to foster a discussion about the global audit networks and their quality control practices to help the board consider what changes might be needed to Appendix K or other quality control standards. I have two more matters to mention, and then we can start the agenda. You are not permitted to use cell phones in the lobby here at the Army Navy Club, and men must wear their jackets when they enter the lobby. We will run this meeting in the manner similar to the way we have in the past. When you decide you would like to comment, please put your name tent up on its side like this, and we will call on you in the order in which you've provided your indication. So now I will move on to the first agenda item, which is a panel discussion on a proposal relating to judgments made by financial statement preparers and auditors. In its progress report dated February 14, 2008, the SEC's Committee on Improvements to Financial Reporting, also referred to by some as CIFR or CIFR, proposed that the SEC should adopt a judgment framework for accounting judgments and that the PCAOB should also adopt a similar framework with respect to auditing judgments. We are fortunate today to be able to hear from two members of the CIFR subcommittee that focused on the development of this proposal. Ed Nussbaum is the chief executive of Grant Thornton, LLP. And Ed, I'm pleased you could be here today. Greg Jonas, the other subcommittee member presenting today, was going to be here anyway, as you know, he's a new member of our standing advisory group. Thank you, Greg, for participating in this presentation. I will now turn the floor over to Ed and Greg. After their presentation, we will open the floor to SAG members.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to make a few opening comments, turn it over to Greg, and then make a few closing comments. And first, let me issue the standard disclaimer here that these comments are Greg and my personal comments. They do not represent comments of the full CIFR committee. They don't represent the conclusions of even our subcommittee, and they probably don't even represent the conclusions of Grant Thornton or, dare I say, Moody's. I'll let you say that. As Tom pointed out, the committee was formed as an advisory committee to the SEC in July of 2007. It was formed to examine U.S. financial reporting, our system, all aspects of it, the process for setting standards, for preparing financial statements, for delivering those financial statements, for regulating compliance, for the audit, oversight, et cetera. And I think it's pretty straightforward why the committee was formed. And it included things like the growing use of international standards and a wide variety of other things. To execute on the objectives of the committee, there were four subcommittees formed. Greg and I are members of subcommittee number three, which is called Audit Process and Compliance. Mike Cook, I think everybody probably knows the name, is the chairman of that subcommittee, and Linda Griggs, a well-respected attorney, is the other member of the subcommittee. We have addressed several things, and we'll continue to address other things as well. We just had a meeting recently where we'll address a wide variety of other things. But one of the things we looked at was professional judgment, and have developed, at the chairman's request, a professional judgment framework. Now, where did this come from? Nobody's really clear how this evolved, but from the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, the SEC was required to do a study of principle-based standards. They did that study, issued a report in 2003, and I'll quote you from that report. It said, "A move to objectives-based accounting standards will require behavior changes, including a change in the way that preparers and auditors exercise professional judgment." So the genesis of this framework was intended to help change behavior, help change the process, help improve documentation, help improve disclosures, help improve all aspects of how preparers reach their professional judgments in issuing their financial statements, as well as auditors and regulators and others involved in the process. In 2006, the SEC Small Business Advisory Committee issued a protocol safe harbor addressing professional judgment. We did not copy that. We did not use a lot of the wording in that. We do not talk about many of the same things we talk about, but it still is necessarily of relevance. Professional judgment's been around for a long time. It's always been necessary and appropriate in the preparation and auditing of financial statements, as well as the regulation of preparers and auditors of those statements. However, the continued progression of standards more towards specificity rules has caused some to assert that preparers are not allowed to exercise judgment in their application. Further, some believe that auditors have increasingly insisted on imposing their judgment on preparers. Our subcommittee concluded that a carefully considered framework that sets forth a strong process that can be expected to result in well-reasoned and supportable professional judgments, and one that specifies that the judgment process must result in an answer that conforms to generally accepted accounting principles, that framework would improve the quality of preparer judgments and make it more likely that preparer judgments will be respected by auditors and regulators, particularly where competent and informed professionals might reach different conclusions. Now, nothing in there is intended, and as an auditor, or some might say a former auditor, it's very important to me and to our committee that nothing preclude the auditor from questioning the work of preparers. And there's nothing in there intended to prohibit that. In fact, it specifically states that the auditors and regulators can question and reverse unreasonable judgments. And we certainly envision a open channel of communication between preparers, auditors, and regulators. And I might also point out that this was not intended to solve all the problems in the world. This is intended to improve the process for judgments, not necessarily to catch material frauds, not necessarily to fix all problems in financial reporting, but to improve the quality of the preparation and auditing of financial statements. And I might also point out that as an individual, I was a little bit skeptical when I first heard about this, but I turned around my view and really became a major supporter of this framework as I realized that I really thought it would improve the judgments that are made by preparers and improve the process that we as auditors go through and the behaviors and processes of regulators. It is something that, when I discussed it with our own professional standards people, they were a little skeptical at first because they realized this might require us to do more work and more documentation, and our preparers, our registrant clients, to do more work. So, with that said, in the process of deliberating about the preparers framework, it became clear that there are issues related to judgments made by auditors and regulators that are by their nature significantly different than those made by preparers. And as a result, we've recommended that the PCAOB consider issues related to judgments made by auditors, its own inspectors, and enforcement personnel. But I'll discuss that more after Greg goes through the details of the judgment framework. Greg?
Ed, thank you, and good morning, everyone. I'd like to cover briefly our goals with the judgment framework. I think there are five. What specifically we are recommending with this framework. And finally, discuss some observations about the framework itself. First, what are we trying to do here? Five things, I think. First, we're trying to improve the quality and reliability of reporting-related judgments. These judgments are critical to the quality of financial reporting, obviously, and some misjudgments have been at the heart of some very important financial reporting failures. Second, we're trying to improve investors' lack of confidence in judgments affecting financial reporting, confidence that's been undermined by some judgment failures. Third, we're trying to establish criteria for judgments and thereby reduce uncertainty about the characteristics of sound judgments. You know, given their importance, it's kind of ironic that there just isn't all that much in the literature that describes the characteristics of good judgments. It's kind of you know it when you see it. Maybe we can do better than that. We think we can. Fourth, we think it's important that a judgment framework help enable principle-based standards. If we're going to move toward principle-based standards, which necessarily rely more on judgment, we think a judgment framework can help. And finally, it can improve preparers' and auditor confidence that regulators will respect well-reasoned judgments. So what are we specifically recommending? First, we recommend that the SEC adopt a judgment framework for accounting judgments, and the committee has put forward an example of a framework. Second, the PCAOB should also adopt a framework with respect to auditing-related judgments. The committee notes that we should take care to implement this in a way that does not limit the work of auditors and regulators. What do we mean by judgments? Well, we mean cast a broad net here. Judgments include choice of accounting principles, application of those principles, financial statement presentation and disclosure, judgments about measurement, and the evaluation of evidence. So it's a broad net related to judgments. The concepts supporting the framework are a few. They are, first, that the judgment framework would not eliminate debate, nor should it attempt to do so. If anything, it focuses debate. Second, the framework organizes analysis and focuses preparers and others on areas to be addressed, thereby improving the quality of judgment and the likelihood that auditors and regulators and others will accept high-quality judgment. Third, the use of hindsight to evaluate judgment where the relevant facts were not available at the time of the initial release of financial statements is not appropriate. Fourth, those who evaluate judgments should evaluate the reasonableness of the judgment and should not base their evaluation on whether the judgment differs from their first choice. And fifth, the framework we do not intend to be mandatory. That is, folks who choose not to follow the framework do not necessarily imply that they've made a weak judgment. Let me talk about some of the components of the judgment framework. The one that we proposed. The framework has two main components. One involves a critical thought process, and the second involves documentation of the judgment and the judgment process. The critical thought process component has 12 parts, and each part is an area to be considered when making a judgment. Thus, these parts do not constitute a process. Processes can be flowcharted, and this judgment framework is not a process flowchart. Rather, they are areas for consideration. Thus, the framework does not in any way restrict analysis. Rather, it offers containers into which analysis is poured. Some components, I think, are obvious and are widely used in making accounting judgments today. Three examples are analysis of the transaction and related facts, analysis of applicable accounting literature, and disclosure in financial statements about the judgment or estimate consistent with today's reporting standards. These, I think, are not surprising. Yet other components of the framework are more subtle, and they are less applied today. And I think they are powerful. They include, for example, that the essence of making judgment is to consider a range of possibilities. Alternative views or estimates articulate the pros and cons related to the range of alternatives, and then explain why you have chosen what you have chosen. Second, when explaining why you've chosen what you've chosen, link the selection to investors' information needs. That is, why is the choice that I'm making best for investors? And second, in the linkage, is linked to what competent external parties are saying about the issue. Judgments are not made in vacuums. And so the more that a party can make a reasoned choice and link their choice to what outside experts, third-party experts, are saying, the more confidence one has in the judgment. Another aspect of the framework that's subtle and important, we think, is to consider the reliability of assumptions and data used. We think a lot of times folks have run with data in judgments without considering really the reliability of the data. And the reliability of the data often is essential to the quality of the judgment. Garbage in, garbage out. Another subtle feature is to seek input from people with appropriate level of expertise and allow a sufficient amount of time and effort for the judgment. We all are familiar with the phrase, a rush to judgment, and that's exactly what we're trying to avoid with the judgment framework. Documentation is the second main component of the framework. And the notion here is to contemporaneously with the judgment document what you've done, and certainly no later than the release of the financial statements. Ed will pick up now and talk about safe harbor issues and then the judgment framework as it might relate to auditors.
Thank you, Greg. Real quickly, a comment on the safe harbor. We are not, CIFR, subcommittee and committee, is not proposing a regulatory exemption safe harbor. The proposal does not contain such a recommendation or proposal. It makes it clear that the framework should not preclude auditors or regulators from asking appropriate questions regarding judgments, as I said before, which is very, very important. We've got to be able to, as auditors, ask questions and as regulators ask questions, even though we are attempting to change the approach that's taking to judgments and the documentation and the behavior. I should also point out that although we talk about safe harbor in there, we leave this up for the SEC to analyze the pros and cons about the safe harbor aspect of this. The framework contains two components, both of which are required: a sound process for making well-reasoned and supported professional judgments, and a requirement that the results of the process result in a solution that conforms with GAAP. We don't go beyond that. It's not intended to protect inappropriate judgments, even when the process has been followed. And it's not intended to reduce, whether it does or doesn't, but not intended to reduce the level of restatements of financial statements. It's intended to improve quality of prepared judgments, and provide auditors with better information to use in evaluating the acceptability of those prepared judgments. Now, let's turn our focus to the PCAOB, because we initially focused on accounting judgments, but we recognize that the auditors, the PCAOB, had a role to play. So the proposed prepared judgment framework was to develop to deal with professional judgments made by preparers of financial statements, and with an auditor's consideration of those judgments. We believe that the existing auditing standards already issued by the PCAOB and out there in the marketplace require an auditor to evaluate the process used by a preparer in making professional judgments as a component of the preparer's internal controls over financial reporting. Professional judgments are involved in the design and operation of internal controls for transactions that occur routinely or can reasonably be expected to occur from time to time. Strong internal controls also recognize transactions or events that are not routine and apply a process for resolving the accounting and disclosure for those matters. Professional judgment framework is intended to deal with these various decisions. There's substantial guidance available to auditors on the evaluation of controls, determining the effect of controls, or the scope of audit work on evaluating the evidence available to auditors to form their audit opinion. But we believe the PCAOB should review existing audit and quality control standards that relate to these issues to assess whether there are areas that are not covered or that may require clarification. I should point out, we don't have all the answers. We're just suggesting that these things be considered. For example, the framework asserts that different competent professionals, given the same information, may reach different conclusions as to accounting and reporting for a transaction or event. Since these situations should normally only result where there is significant uncertainty as to the range of future outcomes, additional guidance or education on evaluating ranges of outcomes might be useful. As intended by the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, PCAOB inspectors represent perhaps the most powerful influence of auditor behavior available to the PCAOB in fulfilling its objectives. Our experience is even the threat of inspection and evaluation of the results of inspections have had a substantial and very real effect on the mindset and thereby the action of auditors. As a result, in order for improvements in preparer judgments to be appropriately considered by auditors, inspection and enforcement policies of the PCAOB should be clear and communicated to audit firms. The PCAOB should review or develop inspection policies, including training and performance evaluations, that would guide inspectors in the review of professional judgments made by auditors. Some components of the inspection framework might be inspectors should first consider whether the auditor had sufficient evidence to assess the accounting and disclosure of the matter being reviewed. Part of this evidence is the information used by the preparer in developing the judgment in the first place. If sufficient evidence was not obtained, there is an audit deficiency that prevents an assessment of the accounting treatment. If the auditor had sufficient evidence to support a professional judgment on the preparer's judgment, The inspector should assess the reasonableness of the auditor's judgment. In doing so, the auditor should have the requisite accounting knowledge to form an opinion. Just as has been proposed in relation to preparer judgments, judgments made by auditors using a sound and properly reasoned approach should be respected by inspectors in performing their inspections. These policies should be communicated to registered audit firms. It's up to the PCAOB to review and develop enforcement policies that appropriately recognize the effects of auditor judgment on the conduct of audits, and the PCAOB inspection policies referenced above in making decisions related to enforcement actions. Again, we're not suggesting we have all the solutions relative to the PCAOB. We're just trying to raise the issue and really turn it over to the PCAOB to take further action. And with that, I'm going to open it up to questions, if that's okay, Don.
Thanks, Ed and Greg. To sort of frame our dialogue, I'm going to throw a couple of questions up on the screen, and as we move through the discussion with the SAG, I think we'd like to take the first two sort of simultaneously because I think they're related. So comments or maybe questions for the panelists with regard to the objectives and elements of the accounting judgment framework proposed by the CIFR, and secondly, whether the SEC's adoption of an accounting judgment framework would have an effect on public company audits, and if so, what effect? Cindy Richson.
Thank you for the presentation on the proposal of CIFR. I read these materials with great interest, and I kept thinking in the back of my mind, even though the SAG materials were very well prepared, and I even looked at the actual report from CIFR, I was asking myself, why are we focused on this issue? All the data that I've seen so far say that basically the post-Enron reforms are working pretty much as intended. For the first time since Enron, restatements are down in 2007. And then I started to think about, you know, the safe harbor proposal, and aren't the auditors supposed to be experts, and why should we give them safe harbor? And in fact, Cindy Fernelli from the Center for Audit Quality basically said she couldn't come up with a single instance of when the auditor's judgment was second-guessed by either the SEC or the PCAOB. And I know that materiality, there's some proposals to weaken the legal definition, so I'm questioning what the legal implications of this. It seems like it leads to either limited liability for auditors or perhaps escaping liability completely as long as you follow these checklists, Greg, that you mentioned, the 12 items or whatever within the framework. And my understanding also is that there is a professional standard already on the books. So it's not a question of what should the auditor do with estimates or other judgments, but whether or not the auditor actually did it. So I listened to, you know, this proposal about more documentation, and all I think about is everybody complained that 404 drove up auditing costs, and it seems to me that if you do a cost-benefit analysis net-net, this will drive up costs. And if you look at the actual implementation of, you know, under the proposal that certain errors may not be corrected at all or may be corrected later than they're required now, that it would not really be beneficial for investors and it would drive up costs.
Joe Carcillo, is that your name tag? Okay.
Are you going to give the panelists an opportunity to respond to Cindy's question?
Certainly. Go ahead.
First point is just to clarify, there is no safe harbor proposal here. None. Zero. Second is I completely agree Sarbanes-Oxley has been extremely helpful in improving the quality of financial reporting. Having said that, I think there continue to be problems. Too many instances of reporting failures, and I think that weak judgments, poorly reasoned judgments, are often at the heart of when failures occur. And so the goal of this framework is to improve the quality and the reasonableness of these judgments, and I think it can help. It's as simple as that.
Joe Carcillo.
Yeah, I have a few-part question that either Ed or Gray can answer. Why is a judgment framework needed? It's not clear to me that There's a lot of discussion about second guessing. And in my view, the role of regulators is not to second guess, but it is to review judgments. So that would be a first question. The second question would be, how would it benefit investors in our investor groups in favor of the framework? And the third question I would ask, particularly as it relates to auditing standards, is Greg made it clear that there's no recommendation in here for a safe harbor, but there clearly is a discussion of a safe harbor versus a policy statement, and that's essentially been punted to the SEC, the PCAOB, as the case may be. And my third question would be, what, if anything, is the Treasury group doing on this issue? And with all due respect to the two gentlemen, I think most reasonable people would look at the composition of the Posen Committee, and the kindest way I can say it would be to say that it's a bit skewed toward the corporate community, whereas the composition of the Paulson or the Treasury Committee, I think most reasonable observers would say is more balanced. And I think if the recommendation came out of that group with non-dissenting, with no dissenting voices, with everybody on that group signing it, I think it would be very hard to criticize it. It would clearly be viewed as a recommendation that strong investor advocates are in favor of. And since some of those people are in this room, I'd be curious as to their perspective on the issue.
Can you repeat the second question? I got the first and third, but I missed the second.
The second one is, are investors in favor of, why is this good for investors, and are investors in favor of the proposal?
Well, let me take the first question. First, why is this needed? In my view, there's precious little guidance that helps people decide when they've made a good judgment or not. And I think, given the importance of judgments, I think we can make genuine progress in raising the bar in what judgments people make and how they support those judgments. I think some of this can be taught. I don't think judgments need to be purely instinct. So why is it needed? I think it's needed because it can be helpful, and we continue to see reporting failures where judgments are at the heart of it. So I think more consideration and work on this topic is time well spent. I think I come to this with an investor perspective, and I have no interest in limiting auditors or regulators second guessing of judgments. None. I voted for this and, in fact, was integral to articulating the 12 components of the framework because, in my experience, when people get their heads into those 12 areas, they make damn good judgments. And when they don't, problems happen. So I had a burning interest in trying to make progress in the quality of judgments and articulating what constituted a decent judgment. And that was the reason for my support.
Yeah, I just to repeat, in a sense, what Greg said, and as representative of an accounting firm, we can do a better job with judgments and professional judgments, and so can our clients, the preparers, registrants of all sides. I mean, I think no matter who I've talked to, from preparers or auditors, have all said this will require some extra effort in improving how we reach professional judgments. Now, that doesn't help the audit costs. A question that came up earlier might end up increasing the amount of time it takes for a company to document their decisions. It might require, hopefully not too much, but a little bit of extra audit time in reviewing that documentation and providing some guidance. But hopefully it'll actually make the audit go smooth, more efficiently, because the intent is that if the preparer does a better job considering the various accounting alternatives, documenting those alternatives, whether it's for an estimate or a choice of acceptable accounting principles, then that should make the life of the auditor and the time the auditor spends easier and less. At least that's the theory behind it. Now, we all know in practice that may vary, but it should improve that process and hopefully improve the process of the PCAOB inspectors and the SEC regulators. You know, like Greg, you know, and as I said in my opening comments, I was initially skeptical. Why do we need this? We already got lots of stuff out there on requiring us to make good judgments. But there isn't a lot of information out there, guidance on how to make those judgments. And as we try to move towards more principle-based standards, which I think are a good thing, well, it's always going to be a combination of principles and rules. It's never going to be a perfect set in either way, or if we move towards IFRS, certainly. I think better guidance on how to make those judgments and how to evaluate those judgments and how to use the right information to factor into those judgments. And maybe it will reduce some of the second-guessing in the sense of second-guessing between, you know, where and which I think is bad for investors, by the way, where the SEC or the audit firm reaches one conclusion one year and then the next year with the same set of facts and the same accounting standards reaches a different conclusion, requires a restatement, and then the next year reverses themselves again and reaches the very same conclusion they reached the first time. Those kinds of things happen, both at the with the accounting firms in our professional standards groups, and that power being collective, all the firms, and at the SEC. And that's not good for investors because usually those decisions, you know, really aren't that they're important decisions, but the users would be better off with more transparency and better information about the judgments that were made. So I think this helps investors, and I am an investor, but I'm not representing the investor groups. I think it helps investors because better judgments will be made, better judgments will be documented, better judgments will hopefully be reviewed by the PCAOB and the SEC and everyone else involved, including the auditors. And while we don't talk about disclosures, I think it'll have the net effect of improving the transparency of disclosures. You know, we debated a lot about whether we should put anything in about disclosure. We couldn't come to any conclusions. But I think the net effect is if everybody has a better understanding of the major decisions that are being made, that will improve the disclosures about those decisions, including some of the non-GAAP disclosures, frankly. With respect to who should be issuing this, I mean, you know, I can't speak for the Treasury Committee. I'm not on it. We have members here that are on the Treasury Committee. But I think the purpose of the CIFR Committee is to look at financial reporting. And this is part of the complexity and reducing the complexity in financial reporting. So certainly it is covered within the scope of what the CIFR and the SEC laid out for the CIFR to do. So whether other committees should look at it as well in some other aspect, or maybe the safe harbor. A lot of people are talking about legal liability for auditors. We have not even talked about legal liability for auditors. I'd love to see this eliminate all of our litigation, but I frankly don't think it's going to do that. So, that's not part of the scope of the CIFR committee, and we really haven't, that's not an objective of the judgment framework, and that we leave to our friends on the Treasury Committee.
Gail and Hansen.
Thank you for being here to present today. I think anytime you shed light on the manner in which we go through a process of arriving at our conclusions is important. This is something that all of us have been involved with throughout our careers and as we were taught even in business school. But at the same time, I'm thinking that perhaps any time in our profession that we have an issue of significance, a framework supposedly is going to solve our problems for us, and I would have to echo the sentiments expressed by Cynthia as well as Joe on this particular subject. I'm wondering, and my specific question for you gentlemen is whether we, and Cynthia alluded to it, there's judgment already in place. I wondered if you looked at Rule 203 of the Code of Professional Conduct. And I have that before me, that rule basically says that if there's a conflict with GAAP that ends up with a misleading answer, then you pursue that, and then based on, and the burden of proof is on the accountant or the auditor, to document a departure with GAAP. And the thing that's a little bit perplexing about this is that a couple years ago when the FASB was looking at the GAAP hierarchy, they proposed to rescind that rule. I think at present it's still on the books. It hasn't been rescinded as of yet. Last time I looked in the Code of Professional Conduct, it's still there. But it does allow the auditor to apply and to exercise professional judgment. And it seems to me like we've almost gone full circle here where we wanted to get rid of this and now we're wanting it back. So I don't know, maybe you could just shed a little bit of light on 203 if you considered that.
Greg's looking at me, so I'll try to answer that. These are all good questions and tough ones, I might add. First of all, you know, I think to your first comment that this will not solve all of our problems, I absolutely agree. I don't think, you know, if anybody thinks that somehow putting out a judgment framework is going to stop the inspectors or the auditors from asking questions or any preparer that thinks that's just not going to happen. Anybody that thinks it's going to solve any other or all the problems in the world and make all the judgments perfect, that's not going to happen. Hopefully it'll make a difference in improving the quality of the judgments. We didn't specifically talk about Rule 203, and I made a note of it, and I'll bring it up on our subcommittee. But what we did talk about is the application of GAAP and whether we should talk about the judgment to apply GAAP or some other aspect. In fact, we spent a lot of time talking about whether we should look at economic substance, and then we realized, of course, that GAAP doesn't always follow economic substance. We talked about fair value, but that's, of course, a nightmare, and we never want to I don't think our subcommittee would ever want to propose it. We don't even all embrace it. And so we really couldn't come up with anything else, you know, other than to say that we want the judgments to be appropriate in the circumstances in accordance with GAAP. But as you point out, there may be times, I don't know when somebody should deviate from GAAP, and I don't know what you do. I mean, that continues to be a quagmire of difficulty for everyone involved. So at the moment, I think GAAP is the best thing we have with all of its faults, and so that's the direction we ended up pushing towards. But we really don't address Rule 203, and whether or not that should be readdressed is probably a very good question.
Barbara Roper.
So I guess the best I can say about this proposal is that I think it's just hopelessly naive. I think it will probably have exactly the intended effect that you say at those good companies that are trying to give the best possible information to investors. And it will provide them with a basis for making better judgments. And then that same flexibility and that same approach at those companies that are not inclined to give investors the best possible information, either that are sort of fudging things or that are pushing really aggressive treatments, it will give them a whole new set of tools to use to argue that the approach they want to use is acceptable. And it will make it that much more difficult for auditors to challenge them because they have to, you know, now we have where does it say in the rules that I can't do this? Now you get, this is my professional judgment and you're supposed to respect my professional judgment. You know, it's not enough to let people ask questions. They have to be able to say no. And, you know, I want my, you know, the auditors of public companies to have all the tools at their disposal to say no when they see someone engaging in something that is simply overly aggressive accounting. And it seems to dismiss the notion of bad judgment, that you can document the heck out of something and you can go through a very, you know, sort of robust process for justifying it and come up with a really bad outcome at the end. And that bad judgment seems, you know, to fall under this category of things that we're going to respect. I also think that while, you know, you're careful to say that this doesn't involve a safe harbor, it was absolutely clear from the discussion at the meeting that this is inextricably linked in the minds of many of the members of the committee to the notion of some kind of safe harbor or some kind of protection both from litigation, from regulatory action. And so while it may not be in the formal recommendations of this committee, I think it is, naive, as I say, to suggest that this isn't very much a part of a proposal that's designed to include either a policy or a safe harbor or whatnot that removes some level of accountability from these decisions. And frankly, I want issuers and auditors sweating bullets about whether they're getting right or not, and I think this is one of many aspects of these committee recommendations that will make that less likely that it will happen.
Arnie Hanisch.
I might be the only one, or maybe the first one here, to speak in favor of this, or at least to support it to some degree. I think from my perspective, as I read this section, okay, which is the accounting framework, I viewed this as a reasonable framework. To me, it was very common sense. I could try to analogize it to the Ten Commandments, you know, that, these are sort of common sense kinds of principles that you would undertake to try to come up with judgment. It doesn't trouble me that, I think that from my perspective when I read this, it enables the debate. It wouldn't certainly eliminate the debate, and I think it would clearly provide the auditors with sufficient substance to suggest, you know, has there been a thorough enough review and analysis of relevant literature? The judgments are only as good as the analysis, and two rational people, after reviewing data and literature, can certainly come to different conclusions. But I don't see where this offends, at least me as a preparer, to have a framework where I can engage in debate with my auditor over principles and judgments. I would hope that if they've concluded that I have a poor judgment, then they're going to tell me so. I mean, hopefully we don't ever come to the conclusion that we have bad judgment or poor judgment, as Barbara was suggesting. But I think it certainly provides a reasonable degree of framework for the debate. And I think probably more importantly, it puts into writing the need for appropriate documentation. I think that what, at least my perception as to what was lacking previously, and I think Sarbanes-Oxley has done a marvelous job of encouraging more documentation, that this certainly encourages and reinforces the need for the thoroughness of a memo that documents the thought process that we as preparers go through in reaching the accounting conclusions and judgments that we bring forward and have to live with every day as part of our roles. The one thing that I am a little bit confused about is this paragraph that's on page 5 where it talks about material issues or transactions that would be analyzed pursuant to the application framework should be disclosed in accordance with existing disclosure requirements. And maybe you can expand a little bit upon that as far as the intent, because I could see here's where we as preparers could get into a significant debate with our auditors as to what are those material issues and transactions that would need to be, in quote, more transparent or disclosed. And to what degree those assumptions and conclusions need to be provided within our filings. That was a little bit troubling to me when I read this. So I would appreciate any additional thoughts you might have with respect to the intent.
Ed or Greg, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I'll start. First of all, I think your first comment is that this is just common sense, and I think in a way you're right, and maybe that's a little naive, but it is a lot of common sense. But I think by putting it in writing and insisting upon it, it will hopefully improve the judgments and promote more good judgment and less bad judgment. And as a former member of the PCOB said to me at a recent meeting, auditing is all just common sense. So it really fits in, and I think that's true. It does fit in perfectly. I think, as you point out, it enables the debate. I don't think there's any question that Sarbanes-Oxley legislation 404 has improved the quality of reporting, at least in my view, and I think in the view of most. And this is just hopefully another step in the right direction. With respect to the comments about disclosure, you know, again, we struggled with that. I think the comment in there, and I don't have the exact wording. Yeah, which basically says that it has to be, as you point out, should be disclosure in accordance with existing disclosure requirements. And so what we did not want to do in this framework, and perhaps the FASB or the SEC or the PCAOB or somebody, whoever has appropriate authority, I guess it's the FASB or SEC, can insist upon additional disclosures. But we did not want to recommend any new disclosure requirements because we hadn't gone through an appropriate process, we think, to recommend any new disclosure requirements. But we think that by forcing people to consider all of these judgments and document them and give them more consideration, that the hopefully the disclosures under the existing standards will improve. You know, so if you consider the accounting principles that you're going to use and you go through this judgment framework to consider those accounting principles, you probably ought to disclose something that's pretty transparent about that accounting principle used in the footnotes to your financial statements. That's already required, I think, by existing disclosure requirements. But hopefully this will make that disclosure better. We're not suggesting that you disclose all the different accounting treatments you considered or any of that kind of stuff, but hopefully you'll give good, transparent disclosures about your conclusions. Now, the execution of this framework is going to vary company by company and auditor by auditor and so forth, and I think there's going to be a learning curve if this is adopted, so that some companies might apply this to 3 decisions, other companies might apply it to 30 decisions. And, you know, and all the range in between. So I'm not, again, we're not suggesting that all 30, if they apply it to 30, necessarily need to be disclosed. That goes to the existing disclosure requirements. So basically, I mean, I hate to say it, but I think we're punting on this and passing it back up to the SEC and the FASB to consider down the road, but with the intent, and a lot of this is about trying to change behavior in the right direction, with the intent that disclosure would improve.
Wayne Collins.
One of the goals that was expressed earlier on was the move towards more principles-based accounting and, of course, principles-based auditing. And it seems to me that the increased discipline that the framework would bring to decision-making is going to be all the more needed in that kind of an environment. Are these processes being undertaken now? I think to a large degree they are, but it's certainly not something that's incorporated within every thought process. So I think it will result in better judgments. And I also wonder, would the mindset change that's going to be necessary over the next few years in the principles-based environment, to what extent there'll be a need for dramatic changes in undergraduate training, not just looking at what the rules are in a particular case, but how to apply a judgment, because that's something that you have to learn very early on in the profession.
Bob Kippers.
Thanks, Tom. Couple things. I think that as to the fundamental objective, as it now says Dell, but it said something before, the fundamental objectives would be to improve financial reporting. If this won't serve to do that, then it's probably not worth pursuing. I think there's a couple of cautions, and I was just picking up on a couple of comments Barbara was making. The operation of any such framework should not serve, and I don't want to be too controversial here, but companies shouldn't be able to hide from their auditors, and auditors should still be able to do the job they're hired to do. And so by following a framework, both, you know, bad faith judgments or folks trying to hide behind, saying, "Well, I followed all the steps, so I have to be right." You can't object to that. I think that would undermine what auditors have to do, what their responsibilities are, and what regulators have to do as well. So I think we'd have to be very cautious that is not the end result. I do think this would tend to reduce restatements. And I think we all have experiences. The question's been asked, you know, where are the examples? Well, in the 1600 restatements from a year ago and the 1300 or so we've had this past year in 07, there are a number of examples where the companies actually believed they had very good support for their accounting positions, but restatements resulted nonetheless. And I think over time this would have the tendency to reduce restatements. many of which aren't serving investors very well because they almost have to be analyzed to find out whether they're problem restatements or whether they're just, you know, journal entries moving money around in the columns, which is so often the case. I guess the other thought is, not that many years ago, if a company came into the SEC and had substantial authoritative support for what they did, there tended to, you kind of reach a draw, and the restatement wasn't always the result. I think today the tendency is that the end result is a restatement, and I would hope that a framework like this would reduce the incidences of what I might suggest are not wholly necessary restatements. And I guess the last point is on the disclosure, Ed. I know that you guys reached a judgment on that, but I would hope that there is a way that there's more transparency into the thought process that the company follows, because I think one of the challenges we have for investors is trying to let them see into the thought process one follows, whether it's to do an estimate or to select an accounting policy. And maybe the existing standards are okay, but I think the SEC should at least consider whether a certain amount of plus disclosure for investors might make this more beneficial.
Let me just clarify one point, and that is Bob referred to steps, suggesting or hinting that maybe this what we're proposing here is a process, and we're not. There are no steps. This is 12 buckets into which one pours judgments. It doesn't tell you how to do it. It doesn't tell you when you're done. There are no steps. So that's why I'm comfortable that this in no way limits auditors and regulators' ability to question, because it's not like you follow the framework, therefore I'm done, because that suggests that there's a process and steps to follow. There aren't. It just says there are 12 things you better think about in making a judgment. Frankly, I think some of those things, which I articulated in my prepared remarks, are things that are not typically done today. And if they were done, I think the quality of our judgments rise. Liz Gatnier.
From the perspective of an auditor, I hear about this thing and I go, what could be the harm in this for you to give me or other auditors or my clients additional guidance on how to make good, well-reasoned, informed judgments? A couple of concerns I have would be, have you then just walked me into a documentation trap where I've made a pretty reasonable judgment, but I have failed in my documentation of what you call the 12 buckets somehow? And you somewhat, I think, answered that by saying that the framework wasn't necessarily mandatory or required, which then leads me to, so now I have to somehow explain that I use judgment in not using the judgment framework, and that one's going to be a tough sell. So I think once you put this thing out here, we have it and we've got it, and it's therefore somehow going to be what we're evaluated against. So I would just caution that what we don't end up creating is another set of problems for all of us.
Damon Silvers.
Joe had asked earlier about the views of people who serve on the Treasury Committee on Auditing. I am the chair of the Subcommittee on Audit Competition in the Auditing Industry of that committee. And I have no authority to speak for either the subcommittee or for the committee, except to say this, that the committee is, that process is a deliberative process that's underway, and it's really not appropriate for anyone to speak about it right now in terms of the substance of what's being said in that process and what people think in that process or what it's likely to result in. However, I am willing to say what I think in relationship to the process that's underway at the SEC and the advisory committee, which has presented some documents in which there's something to talk about properly. And it's a long document with obviously a lot of thought has gone into it. Some of it, I know the chairman, Bob Posen, has been drafting things around these ideas for a long time. The And I guess I have a couple of general responses. I won't take a long time responding to that document as a whole. The first is that I think there really is a need here to have understand a context. In the Treasury Committee, this enterprise, various other discussions that have gone on about auditing and accounting rules, are going on in a context in which we are living through what appears to be a profound failure of judgment in relation to the subprime crisis. So there's a certain amount of urgency here, and it seems to be a profound failure of judgment among issuers and among and perhaps among auditors and credit rating agencies and so on and so on and so forth. And I think there's just an inadequate attention to context in these discussions generally. Secondly, I really don't understand what exactly these recommendations, and not just in the judgment area but in other areas, are intended actually to change. And I don't understand that in two respects. I don't understand because I'm not an auditor and I'm not a CPA and I'm not fully conversant in all the details of the rules. I don't understand how this framework would purport to change the current standards of professional care as they exist, say, in the auditing profession or among CPAs that work for issuers. I don't understand it. Secondly, and I will read to you from your document so that we can all be talking about the same thing. The document states, the document you provided us with says that in relation to the safe harbor issue, that, of course I can't find the page now, but it says, some have proposed that a, quote, safe harbor be developed that protects the exercise of judgment in accordance with a specified framework. That approach would seem to provide greater support to auditors and preparers than a statement of policy. However, it is unclear to us whether a legal or regulatory safe harbor, i.e. an effective legal or regulatory defense based on conformity with the framework, could be adopted by the SEC or whether it required changes to existing statutes. Another approach is for the SEC and the PCAOB to issue policy statements that describe a framework for the exercise of professional judgment and state that auditors, the SEC or the PCAOB as applicable, will take into account the implementation of the framework in evaluating a judgment made by a registrant or an auditor. Now, the SEC and the PCAOB, in that sentence, you're describing their exercise of their law enforcement authority. Right? And then there's the broader issue of private litigants and private rights, both rights of issuers who feel that they've been wronged by their auditors and rights of investors. There are four legal frameworks in general that govern the behavior of auditors, which I think is sort of more relevant to this discussion in that area. They are the duties of professional care under state law, the duty not to violate the securities law, commit fraud, the requirement that the company financial statements be accurate, which is sort of drives restatements. And it's very different because it's very different than these duties around fraud and around professional care, because you can exercise due professional care and have no liability for a breach of duty of that duty. You can not have been involved in a securities fraud. You can have been an honest and upright person entirely as the auditor. But if you still make a mistake, and it's a material mistake, it has to be corrected. If that's not true, we don't have accounting standards. Right? And then finally, there's the regulatory oversight, which the last sentence I read applies to. Regulatory oversight by the SEC, more or less enforcing the accuracy issue, and the regulatory oversight by the PCAOB, which was the subject of a great deal of your earlier remarks, in the inspection process, which is a more qualitative oversight process. I do not understand in what respect, if any, you are suggesting changing these things. And if you're not suggesting changing any of them, I don't understand what change you're actually proposing. And I think that the punchline here, right, is that this effort, which I think is well-intentioned, in relation to the notion that we ought to maybe give some more guidance around what judgment is, this effort needs substantially more work. And in that regard, I think several of us in the Treasury Committee have been invited to join you all in San Francisco next month to discuss some of these issues. Unfortunately, we've been invited to do so on the date that the Treasury Committee is meeting in full session in Washington. I hope we can work that out and we can have these discussions in some greater detail.
Let me just a very quick reaction. First, I Damon certainly agreed that this needs a lot more thought. And we put up a straw person framework that I don't think we suggest is God's gift to this or the final word on this. I thought we did it to try to make come alive how a framework could help make better judgments. As to your excellent legal points, I don't think we thought that through from a legal perspective. It should be thought through. So I think you're making excellent points. And, we certainly hope we can have more dialogue about this and welcome it very much.
Thanks. Let me just pause for a moment here, recognizing we still have a lot of people to hear from and we want to hear from you. I foresee us running into our break time a little bit, so please have patience with us on that point. Let me also just remind you of the other questions that we teed up for discussion. And kind of looking at the clock, my sense is we may end up having to bring these questions back to the SAG again. But in case you have some thoughts on them as we finish today's session, please provide them. But again, we may need to bring... Would that have an effect on audits, and if so, what? And what elements should be included in that framework for auditing judgments? And then suggestions on how the board could implement a framework so that it doesn't limit the ability of auditors and regulators to ask the appropriate questions. So with that, let me continue going around the table and take your comments. Randy Fletchall.
Thanks, Tom. I want to go back where Cynthia started this conversation, although, as usual, Bob Kipper's remarks preempted most of mine, so I'll try not to be too redundant. Cynthia, restatements may be coming down, but they're still at an incredibly high level, and I think everyone agrees that we run the risk of significant ones getting lost in the maze of the number of restatements. And I'll tell you, there's no preparer, no auditor who wants to be associated with one, even if they feel more commonplace these days. So I think that is an issue we need to deal with, and as Bob admitted, said, we need to do that. We can't sit here and get into the details of client specifics in a forum like this, but the fact that we can't doesn't mean that in that 1,000 to 1,200 to 1,500, 1,600, 1,800 restatements, how you want to count them, that there aren't more than a few instances where a preparer or an auditor's view that was well-reasoned, well-thought-through, good faith, preparers or others would say they don't think it was sufficiently respected or upheld. And so that's when you say, why do we need it? Yeah, things are going the right direction, but we need to move, I'd say even faster in that regard. And to Barbara's point about a move to a more principles-based system, including IFRS, I think it's not that people are looking for a free pass or to say, well, just trust my judgment and there's nothing else you can do. But if we don't have behavioral change that Ed mentioned at the outset, moving to a more principles-based system in the U.S. is not going to be very successful, and that requires behavioral change from preparers, from auditors, from regulators, and I think that's what the driving force is behind this. And I couldn't agree more with the notion that while the advisory committee's recommendation right now is disclosure within the existing framework, I think that's an area that also needs further consideration in terms of a benefit to investors coming out of this process.
Vin Coleman?
Yeah, I apologize at the risk of perhaps being a little bit redundant. I do think something that's missing from this conversation just a little bit, if we could ground it, is to go back to remember that this framework, at least the way I read it, we went right to the auditors, and I think we got to start at the preparers. Because I think we got to start from the way I look at this, and I want to maybe talk about what our firm has begun to do. This was around trying to drive better quality in the decision-making, knowing that this world is moving today. It was not around trying to get to a corner and then allow somebody in the system to use it as an excuse. That would be a race to the bottom. It would be, in my view, if this is applied appropriately, and I'm not suggesting this is the perfect framework, and I think a debate to make it better, particularly in the area around transparency for investors, I think would make a little bit of sense, and I think that could be debated. But when you go through this framework in an appropriate manner, it would be very difficult, more difficult than today, to have a judgment that is out of bounds. And what would help auditors
and the whole system is at the time you're making a decision, similar to some of the themes that came from, and I would just ask people to think through, in December at the SEC conference, there was an acknowledgement that there can be more than one right answer with a given set of facts. And we're only going into that direction more and more as the standard setting is becoming more principles-based versus rules-based. If you have a rule, you can just simply look at it, no matter what the economics are, look at it, follow the rule blindly, and move on. We're moving away from that. We're moving then to the international standards, and when people say, is there a need for this, I would suggest to you, as an auditor and a practitioner, there is a need for this. And when you go through time, the efficacy of the documentation a preparer has to look at the appropriate literature, look at the linkage to the literature, analyze what those alternatives are, and whether or not the linkage to the substance of the transaction, the underlying economics, and think through the transparency for an investor is a process of behavioral change like Randy was just talking about that could be extremely healthy and, in my view, beneficial for the whole system and the investors. I think when you talk about cost, could there be an incremental cost? I'm not so sure. I think people go through that process today. What it will do is help with the discipline when you look back of the thought process you're going through that you expect in some of the standards, Damon, you referred to, but those standards are so broad that there need to be some type of guidance and framework for each people in the system, including the regulatory authorities, that everybody's at least has the same level of expectation, and that would help.
David Becker.
Just some experience that may help people evaluate how this would work in practice. Lynn and I, when we were at the SEC, were part of an effort to introduce a certain degree of intellectual rigor into the making of a materiality judgment. In doing SAB 99, I just come to the SEC after a background as a defense lawyer. And the number of times I had heard, and I have since heard, people trying to explain what they did, including accounting matters, and say, well, you know, it's my judgment. All right, well, what does that mean? Well, it's my judgment. Okay. And the idea is to insert into that, as I say, a framework for thinking about it and for going through a process so that what's called judgment is not merely taking refuge in the ineffable, but the end result of a serious process. I think that's a good thing. I have a little skepticism as a result of the SAB 99 experience about how this will work in practice. We did SAB 99. The principal point was this is not a bright line. This requires the exercise of judgment, and your judgment should be informed by the following factors. And I think the text and subtext was, and if you do exercise your judgment this way, it will be respected. And speaking only for myself, I mean, to be sure, part of this was to stem what seemed to be a tide of very loose materiality judgments, but it was written in a way that was intended to constrain the discretion not only of preparers and auditors, but regulators as well in simply saying, nah, it's material. I don't think it has been taken quite the way I would have hoped it was taken on all sides. That instead of saying, this is a matter of judgment and these are the things you have to look at, Instead, I think it has been taken more as a cookbook with a more complicated recipe than used to be there before. And I would worry for those who want to move to more principle-based systems, and I have some questions about what exactly that is, but I would worry that the problem is not principle-based or lack of principle-based rules, but do you have principle-based humans out there? So that no matter how you put it, it's going to be taken by preparers, by auditors, and by regulators as a more complicated recipe for doing what people already do, and that perversely, this becomes something of a litigation trap, that even if you have a safe harbor that says, if you do these things, there will be no liability. And frankly, if it's the case that this produces better accounting decisions, I don't mind having a safe harbor. I might want to wait and see before I put a safe harbor into effect. But what happens is that by proceduralizing the decision-making somewhere, you then have grounds for enhanced liability. So that even if the judgment is defensible, if the documentation is crappy, you may find yourself with more complicated legal proceedings, having lawyers prepare documentation. Well, never mind. I'm in favor of it. thanks.
Jeff Mahoney.
Two points. First, on restatements, I'd just like to point out that on February 15th, Glass Lewis put out a report on, on the 2007 restatements, found that restatements had declined among companies of all sizes. Restatements to correct accounting errors was down 15%. I believe this is the third year in a row that, at least for those companies who have implemented Section 404, that restatements have declined. In addition, it's my understanding the Treasury Department has a major study underway with a professor from Kansas on the reasons for restatements of public companies, so I would think it might be appropriate to wait for the results of that study and consider the results of that study and other information in deciding what changes should be made with respect to restatements. The other point, David read some from the report. I want to read two more sentences along the same lines on page 66. It says, quote, "It is unclear to us whether, as a matter of regulatory strategy, this judgment framework should be implemented through a safe harbor or policy statement. We leave to the SEC and its staff the resolution of these difficult issues." So the report does leave open the possibility and doesn't object to the idea that the implementation may be through a safe harbor. It's my perception, and I could be wrong, but it's my perception that most institutional investors would oppose this framework because they, I think, would believe that this safe harbor would reduce audit quality rather than enhance audit quality. I know both of you speak to a lot of investors as part of your broad range of responsibilities. I just wonder if you comment as to whether or not you believe my perception is correct. Thank you.
With regard to safe harbor, personally speaking, I'm opposed to a safe harbor. I think the language got in the report the way it is because the committee wanted to decouple the notion of a framework, which we think is a good idea, from a separate consideration about whether there's any safe harbor or how it's enacted, and separate those two pretty cleanly, because we were of the notion that a framework is a good idea regardless. I suspect that all investors, Jeff, would be opposed to anything that they believe would restrict an auditor's ability to do their job or a regulator's ability to do their job, including second-guessing judgments. So to the extent that a safe harbor, if implemented, would do that in the minds of investors, I can almost promise you what investors would say.
I've convinced myself that this judgment framework is a good idea, because I think in no way would it, and I'm saying without a safe harbor, in no way would this restrict. In fact, it would foster the kind of debate that I think we need to have around judgments, because it points out things like you got to consider alternatives, not just one answer, your favorite. You got to think about the range of alternatives, look at the pros and cons, pick the one that reconciles best to user needs, and then reconcile what you've done to what outside third-party experts are saying. I don't think those things are done very much today. And I became convinced that that's a trade-off. And I think investors, when explained that way, would probably support it. So I think you're right about concern about safe harbor and what feelings that would conjure up in the minds of investors. But the committee, in the committee's minds, the reason we have the language here the way we do is we were trying to separate the two issues.
I'm going to go ahead and extend this session to 10:30, at which point we will take a 15-minute break. It will still be a challenge, I think, to hear from everybody, so please keep that in mind, and please do try to keep your comments as brief as possible. Lynn Turner.
Actually, I find myself agreeing with some of the things that Greg has talked about. I do think there were a lot of poor judgments at the heart of many of the failures which he mentions. And I don't think a safe harbor, I agree with him that there should not be a safe harbor. It's not going to be in the best interest of the profession, in part because of the exact reasons that David Becker pointed out earlier. We have heard input over at the Treasury Committee that from very well-known former senior officials besides David, people who have been actively involved in that role at the SEC and Corp Fin, who have clearly indicated to us that this safe harbor, rather than driving, or this business judgment rule, rather than driving down litigation, will actually turn out to be the very basis for litigation and will, in fact, drive the amount of litigation against the firms up. And certainly that's one of the factors that we're weighing at and looking there. And as Damon said, we're still going through that process. So, but it does raise some serious questions. And as I think about it and go back where you remarked, Greg, I do think you guys didn't think about that. And I think the other thing is on the safe harbor, it's clear it got teed up and got thought here. If members of the committee don't support the safe harbor, your report would be much more transparent if, in fact, you noted members don't support the safe harbor. I think that would be of great interest to investors. But going to the question that Tom Ray has teed up about the elements, I was listening to Arnie, and Arnie talked about this thing is like the Ten Commandments, and I agree with Arnie. It is very much like the Ten Commandments, and of course we know how well people follow those, which gets us back to litigation all over again. So, but when you go through and you just look at these 10 factors, you know, or 9 factors and documentation. By the way, on Enron, there was plenty of documentation. There was plenty of documentation. In fact, one audit partner had said there was so much documentation he disagreed and got pulled off the audit. So we know, you know, that's not the type of documentation hasn't always been the problem. But when I look at this, it says, first one, analyze the transaction. Well, voila, that's probably a pretty good idea that you analyze the transaction. Make sure you get all the material facts. Not a bad idea. Who can argue with that? So, you know, review the literature. Make sure you got all the literature and understand it. Well, I think you got to do that if you're going to opine on GAAP. Consider alternative views or estimates. That's basically already out there in the SAS on auditing estimates already. 5, the rationale for the choice. So you got to have a basis for what you're deciding. Sounds pretty rational to me. Linkage of the alternative estimates to the substance and the business purpose. I think that's pretty much there in the existing SAS. Diversity in practice, that gets back to the GAAP. Consistency of application, you're already required to do that under GAAP. 9, the appropriateness and reliability, that is specifically language out of the SAS. So when I look at the elements, the second question you got up there, Tom, there's nothing here that isn't already out there, common sense. And I turn around and say, does the profession really need a rule to turn around and say, go look at GAAP, go make sure you got all the facts, and make sure you analyze them? That's all this says. And if you're going to turn around and hang yourself with litigation by going to this, I got to turn around and say, who in their right mind would turn around and do this? It is not well thought out. It doesn't add anything. As Galen mentioned, Rule 203 already gets you to some of the judgment stuff, and that can add it up with the SAS. What would help out, which, and Ed, I think you're right, I think the committee did go three and out and punted on disclosures. And what we've heard on our committee in public hearing is that's what investors want. And that's what they think will help fix the problem more than anything. Give us the range of those estimates. Give us the key data and assumptions that go into those. And let's get those disclosures out. And then let the market discipline. When that information is out there, as the CFA Institute rep told us during his testimony, the market can get there, the analysts can get their hands around it, and they'll take it from there. But if you're telling me, and we've heard it time and time again from each of the firms today, not each of them, but from a couple of them, that they aren't doing today what they need to be, that they aren't doing those basic fundamental things in those 9 items. If they aren't doing these basic fundamental things today, that should be concern for every investor. Because those are nothing more than plain common sense. You don't need a rule to know you got to do this to do an audit.
Sam Ranzillo.
Well, I will try to be shorter than Lynn. I make 3 observations. One is, at a fairly high level, as I followed the discussions at the committee around the framework, it just struck me the fact that reasonable people thought they had to develop a framework for the use of judgment implicates to me a much broader issue with the entire system that would cause reasonable people to believe that you have to put a framework together on respecting somebody's judgment. And it's like a patient coming in with cancer and a headache and a doctor dealing with the headache and ignoring the other. So it just strikes me that this whole exercise, while I'm in support of a framework, is a broader implication of our entire system. Secondly, I would like to emphasize, at least from my own perspective, that I could not support any framework that in any way would inhibit an auditor from doing its job. And I appreciate the comments, but I will tell you the words themselves that are in the report caused me some concern as to whether or not that could end up being a very significant unintended consequence. And thirdly, I'd like to repeat, I think, very quickly around disclosures. I'm not here to debate whether this committee should have punted or not. I think that's for you to decide. But I think for this framework to ultimately have its a significant contribution to investors, the next step has to be that disclosures have got to be enhanced around these significant judgments. I think there's some frameworks that are out there that have been discussed before that never were put into place. And I think if you're going to take this thing all the way down the path of improving the judgments, and I'll grant you that maybe that will happen, then the disclosures have got to be enhanced as a product of that process.
Dick Dietrich.
First, no disclaimer, because I'm going to speak for the education community, and as you would know, I can't speak for them because they speak for themselves all the time. I have a question, but I'm going to sandwich it between two comments. The first comment is this idea of creating frameworks for judgment is something that has been well researched in an area called judgment and decision making. Let me give you a quick example. One of the games that instructors who do this in class do is to take a soda can that has been filled with pennies and then offer it for auction to students in the classroom. The highest bidder wins. The way it works out, the highest bidder is the one that's got the worst judgment. All right? And so then the instructor can go back through and talk about how to do a decomposition so that first one might think about how many pennies fits in a cubic inch, how many cubic inches are inside the can, things like that, to do decompositions. The framework here that I think is being proposed is one that adopts, as Lynn says, things that are already common sense or in the literature, but puts them in a very specific way to help people understand how to do that decomposition. And so to the extent that that's an innovation that we're not now teaching at the university level or that is not being used in practice is a very helpful thing. But that leads me to my question, and that is, why do we need to do this through any kind of action other than private action? That is it not possible for preparers to simply adopt this framework? If they want to do so, they can disclose that they're adopting the framework. Their auditors can look at it and see if that's improving the decision-making process. They can use that in making their audit judgments. While I will also concede that I think to a large extent we are not doing this in the university now, I think we can if there's demand for people to be trained like this. We couldn't do it immediately, and as I have said in prior meetings, we need to be careful about things that place rigidities and inflexibilities on university education. One of them would be the CPA examination, for example. So if we wanted to have people develop this framework, give us a CPA examination that would ask the students when they're taking the exam to use these steps or parts of these steps. They could take one step, for example. You could make a question on a particular step or ask them if they can use that entire framework. If you start to build the exam that way, I can assure you that our students will come prepared to pass the exam that way. But I can also tell you it won't happen overnight. I will also remind you we now have two courses on valuation that we put in, an international financial reporting course, an ethics course, and I think I might have had one other course. So we're going to change the curriculum here very rapidly through these meetings. And so I really appreciate your suggestions. I take them back to my comments on our colleagues on a regular basis. And we really can do these things in education. So it'll take us time to get there. But we have to decide what it is we want these people to look like. And at the end of the day, those decisions will be made with your offers to students who are better prepared than those who are less well prepared. And so if you don't make those judgments, you won't see the changes.
Would the panel like to briefly respond to Dick's question?
The question, Dick, relates to why not just do this in private practice? Why do we need to put it in standards? I think there's countless places in standards where we say, think about these things. These are things you could think about. That's all we're proposing here with this framework. And we were proposing that it be put into the literature for the reason we often put into literature, you know, things to think about, because this is what we want and expect people to do. That was the only logic. It's no better than that. I agree that the more we talk about framework such as this, and the more we talk about ways to raise the bar on judgment, even if the SEC did nothing, it's a good thing that we talk about this stuff, because I do believe, I'm absolutely convinced, this is an area of low-hanging fruit that has not had enough intellectual discussion.
Mike McCauley.
I'll just be brief.
I think a judgment rule is reasonable for many of the reasons that have been voiced by the supporters anyway. I think as the shift occurs away from GAAP and a rules-based kind of paradigm into a global standard, I think we've couched this as, you know, should we have a judgment rule? And I would go a little bit further than that. It almost sounds like it we need one. It necessitates such a framework. And I would also underscore Lynn and Sam's comments on disclosure. That's absolutely critical. If investors don't get the adequate and proper level of disclosure, I think that'll be a big loss, a big deficiency in any final framework, and will significantly reduce its effectiveness, because investors have to know and understand, and without the disclosures, they're just simply not in a position to be able to do that. So those are my comments, but I had a question. I think unless I misheard you, I think you said, well, I can't remember which one, it's made the statement that it was going to be optional, or they could choose to apply the judgment framework or not adhere to it, and that would, I think, cause investors some concern.
Howard Johnson.
Yeah, if this framework was going to be adopted as far as auditing judgment, I've heard a lot of terms thrown out here. It's a requirement, Ten Commandments, cookbook, roadmap, things to think about. Maybe it's the best practice. Maybe this should ought to be standard operating procedure, or is it guidance? That's going to be a big thing to determine, and who will review it if it is adopted as a framework. Would it be part of the PCAOB inspection process down the road, or would it be just something that you look at if something bad happened about the during the audit or something, to see what kind of process was used? If it's not a requirement, if it's things to think about, a best practice or whatever, I don't see how you're going to be able to. You can't audit against mush, as I used to say. You got to have some kind of a requirement in place. And I know we have the PCAOB puts out standards. Now this is going to be a standard about a framework. That's what it would have to be, I think, if you were actually going to be able to review against it. Anything else, it really wouldn't be required. And as I read this whole document, this sounded to me like what I always said internal auditing is about. It's just applying good business judgment to the situation at hand. I mean, that's what auditing is all about. I thought it was a good document. If you're going to make this stick, you've got to make it a requirement that's subject to review.
Bob Dacey.
Thanks. I just had a couple observations on the question about PCAOB developing or adopting a framework. One of the questions was, what would this involve in terms of auditing judgments? We've talked a lot about the accounting judgments, but it seemed to be in the paper here that the proposal was this would extend more broadly to other auditing judgments. In looking at AS3, we talk about the concept that exercising professional judgment exists in nearly every aspect of planning, performing, and reporting on an audit. So it wasn't clear in terms of what the expectation was and how far this would go. But also in looking at AS3, at least we seem to identify those areas that we want auditors to document judgment, and those would be in the exercise of conclusions on relevant assertions and on significant matters, which include the selection and application of accounting principles. So just a question as to how broadly you would want to apply this to judgments. It would seem, again, to us that AS3 provides that level of what should be documented. Perhaps this somehow fits into that framework in terms of documenting enough information. AS3 allows a lot of judgment in what you document. So I'd just like to offer that up. I think in terms of the factors, we looked at those and thought about what would we use, and we couldn't come up with any more. So I think that was a good list. But we wouldn't want to limit exercise of auditor judgment. There are standards like the audit risk and materiality and the interim standards that allow the auditor to make judgments about management's judgments, and if they differ, to consider those misstatements, and also to consider whether there's a possible bias. Even if management's estimates all fall within a reasonable range, you still have to stand back and say, is there a possible bias here? So we think there's things to do. The other question we would have is the result of the inspections looking at the implementation of AS3 and perhaps the standard on 312 on risk of materiality, finding any issues with where these judgments weren't adequately documented in the audit documentation. Wasn't real clear on that and whether there's anything there in terms of PCOB inspection experience that would provide some guidance into where these where this documentation needs to be improved or guidance on the documentation. And lastly, I guess, kind of going on Howard's comment, we weren't really sure if this would be authoritative guidance or what it would be in terms of a PCOB audit standard or some other guidance that we don't quite have, non-authoritative, what kind of class of guidance or standard it would exist in. Thanks.
Pat Harned.
There have been a lot of comments and great questions asked about are there principle-based people out there and what do we want people to look like? And I just thought I would offer a couple of thoughts from research that my center has done that might be useful in putting this framework into context. My center does a lot of work in trying to understand how you help people make good decisions, how you make good judgments. And by good, I mean with the highest of integrity, both for yourself and the organization you're representing, but also the clients that you're serving. And an observation I would make from what we've seen time and time again in different workplaces is that the more you provide processes and rules and very specific standards for how people should go about doing their jobs, the more you have even the most highly educated professional individuals struggling to find the courage it takes to make judgments when the rules aren't clear. And there are not many organizations out there that help people to think through the gray area situations. Why is that? It's a culture problem. It has to do with the fact that rules-based situations make it more difficult for people to actually navigate those gray areas. So one thing that is successful in those workplaces is providing a broad framework to help people to reason their way through those gray areas. And so the question I would raise as you're thinking through what should this judgment framework actually look like is how can it be leveraged to not just address the individual circumstance where you're trying to reason your way through it, but how can it also be helping to try to change the culture situation?
David Julian.
I'd have to agree with others who said that most, if not all, of the aspects of the framework feel like common sense and reasonable practice. You know, from a preparer's point of view, I think there's probably three groups of folks. Those are out there making sound judgments, and if they are, they're probably applying many of the aspects of this framework as they go about it. On the opposite end, I think you have those who are making not so sound judgments due to biasness, and I think any framework, they're still probably going to find a way to arrive at those judgments. And then you're in the middle where there probably are some folks who, with a more disciplined framework, might have arrived at a better judgment. And it feels like this proposal is going after that middle group. I've heard you say that it would not be required. It would be things to think about. As a preparer, my fear is that when something gets written, when something gets published in the rules, as something to think about, it becomes best practice, and very quickly, from a preparer's standpoint, it becomes a rule. And informal or formally, either the firms or others will make rules around it for a preparer to then have to follow. And I'm concerned about the burden that places on the majority of folks who are already applying these, aimed at trying to fix that middle group that perhaps could use this. And I just don't know whether the burden that it will end up applying on the preparers is worth going after helping that middle group, which I'm not convinced is the larger of the problem. Thanks.
Gary Kalperek.
Tom. Thank you. I'll speak from a preparer's perspective also, and I think to try to net it out, I think as the proposal stands now, it actually is workable, and I think it's a really good first step in it. I think what it does is appropriately recognizes that judgments are a big part of what we do every day, routine stuff and extraordinary stuff, and looking at that we have rules and guidelines and frameworks for almost everything else, you know, sort of rhetorical question, well, why not have a framework? And so I think we should proceed down this route. I really do think this would be useful in organizing the management thought process. When we look at it and see analyze issues, you pick it and you try to usually write up why it's the right answer to do, but this framework will more consistently bring companies to think, what are subject matter experts outside of your company in the industry saying, for example. So I think you'll think more outside of the box, you know, with the framework as it's currently written. I think that's a good thing. I think Arnie and Lynn, a bunch of others, said a lot of this stuff is already out there. It's common sense. So I think putting everything in one place is a good thing. FASB's doing a codification framework. With that in mind, it's put what's out there in one place, which is just easy to get to. You know, whether or not this is should become codified or rule and at what level, I'd probably leave it to the board and the SEC or whoever to decide. Where does it fit in the gap or the gas hierarchy that's out there? I think the one concern I would have on workload is, I mean, there's judgments, you know, that are routine, ordinary course of business, well established. Then there's, I'll call it the extraordinary judgments of current issues and material, recent events, and so on. I'd like to, assuming a rule emerges, sort of get it focused, I'll call it, to the extraordinary events as opposed to routine judgments, whether it's depreciable lives or routine reserves and so on. You don't necessarily want to be documenting stuff that you know how to do and is well established. I think it's, I'll call it, the disclosable events of the period is probably what we try to narrow it down to. So, and then lastly, I think no matter how this evolves, there's nothing in here I don't think that would stop the auditors from exercising whatever audit process or audit issues they wish to raise and to challenge.
Ernie Baugh.
Along with an awful lot of other people, I think most of these things that we're talking about here are just common sense. Given that, I think there's an awful lot of people that don't have a lot of common sense. Consequently, I think pointing things like this out as things that should be considered in making a judgment is probably a good thing. The other thing that I want to echo is as we move to less rules and more principles-based standards, the primary objective is to have principles-based accountants and auditors trying to follow those rules. I think that's going to be the critical thing. We've got to have principles-based people following principles-based rules.
Joe Carcello, did you want to speak again?
I do, but we've only got 3 minutes. Do you want to keep going?
Let's go ahead and use the 3 minutes, and let's get in as many of you as we can. I think we've heard from everyone at least once who wanted to speak. Am I missing? Have we overlooked someone? Okay, so go ahead, Joe, and we'll.
I'll try to cut down what I was going to say, because some of the others have said it as well. I think, you know, Greg and Ed certainly have come across as presenting this as a belief that this will improve practice. And, you know, as I read it, I didn't disagree with Arnie. I think it's actually a reasonable framework. I think where people get uptight is when you start talking about safe harbors. And I won't quote from them in the interest of time, but I have the 3 comment letters from the CEOs of 3 of the big 4 firms, and they link this framework to liability reform within 3 paragraphs of talking about the 2 different issues. And when that kind of coupling happens, investors and people who care about the public interest get nervous. So I would second what Lynn said. To the extent that there is a belief on the group that a safe harbor is not a good idea, I think if you articulate that, then I think people will be more likely to view the framework as a good faith framework.
Okay, I'm going to grant Barbara Roper the final word. Thanks.
I think that one of the things you have to keep in mind when you look at this is that this is a process, a framework that would be very easy to manipulate by the next Andrew Fasto. He could, you know, that person, whoever it is who's out there now, we can assume, could go through this entire framework, do all of the documentation, and come up with a bad application of accounting standards. And with or without a safe harbor, there is an implication that we are supposed to respect professional judgments that's built into this idea. And if that's adopted, sort of formalized, with or without a safe harbor, it will be that much harder for the auditor of that company to have the backbone to stand up against that aggressive accounting practice. And, you know, showing backbone in these situations has not been a strength of the audit profession in the past, and they have done better when they have been backed by stronger enforceable regulations. I would also say that the statement, and I'm taking it out of context, that you can't audit against mush is one of the best critiques of principles-based regulation I've ever heard. And we've talked a lot about how all of this is intended to reduce complexity. But from the point of view of investors, a set of proposals that permits and even encourages greater diversity of application of the accounting rules does not result in less complexity. It results in less comparability from company to company, from year to year, and that is not a reduction of complexity that is useful for investors.
I would just like to observe I found this discussion to be enormously helpful to me personally, and I appreciate the comments that we've heard today.
I just repeat what Greg said. I mean, we came in here, I certainly came in here with an open mind. We've got a lot of good comments and a lot of things that I think we need to reconsider, and hopefully everyone else learned something from it and had equally open mind, and we all benefited from the discussion. So thank you.
Ed and Greg, thank you very much for your presentation. We will break now and reconvene in 15 minutes.